Hi.
So my name is Meg Ramey, and I did a prose thesis, so I wrote 4 fiction stories, but recently this semester I also wrote poetry, so I'm going to read a poem first, and then I'm going to read from my thesis, and I wish I had included this in my thesis. This is called Violet. Where is Violet? This is called Violet. There are no spoons here. You can try next door at the Burks or down the road at the bodega if you want to get your hands dirty, but there are no spoons here at present. There are no spoons here for you, Pat O'Doole, but do you have a knife to sharpen? There are none for the twin you saved when she toddled out of her backyard. Runaway Faye, you call her 16 years later. There goes Runaway Faye. Do you have any ice skates, Joe or Joe? No, we do not have spoons here. But cross the broken sidewalk, you, drunk, without a home. Push your shit aside into the corner, please, and prop your mattress on the fence while you're away. Arrange your rags, street man, and bring your knives to sharpen. I see you've heard my bell, Orthodox Jew, but there is nothing around here to be sold to you or your black lover. But bring your scissors, might he need them to trim his dreadlocks? Sharpen your scissors here, Joe and lover Joe, who drowned the tabby cat. Mosey to my truck when you have a block party. Slip down to my apple red truck. Do not confuse me for the firemen that siren in, how ostentatious, to open hydrants for the children. Have your husband watch Violet and run away, Faye. Visit, bring your ice skates. Do not step in the shit on the corner. You, fat neighbor, do you have cause for sharpening? With your parents dead, will you come to my truck? Your obesity, your middle years, they hear you play cans for lack of drums. Sad neighbor, the gang member saw you before he drove off to Maine, they say. He saw the drunk exit from your basement doorway, trailing his shit-stained, twice-chewed coat. Zip up your fly when he comes, and I will realign your blade. But we do not sell spoons here. Vomit, woman, 6 feet from my truck at least. Do not ask me for money again. I know where your bus comes from, and so do the Joes and the Arabs on the corner. If you are hungry, eat your meth, deranged woman. Untwist your face, and do not beg the man who the twins think is grandpa. Eat your arm. I've seen you do it. But do not yell at me inches from my face. Lower your voice and align your left eye. We do not sell forks here either. By God, do not touch Runaway Faye. If it was you, drug pusher, who drowned the cat, you can blame the neighborhood riot on morning, and I should know. I backed up 3 crowded blocks to make way for their chains and crowbars. They slashed your tires. Take the train downtown and no need to come back. Please bring your collector's swords. I sharpen mine once a week. So if you are a mother and would like to see, we do not sell spoons here, but my mother is gone and there are no block parties for me. My truck won't intrude. Let me sharpen you and yours. I am alone with my knives, you see, but for your faces and your habits. Come down with a blade for me, please. Where have you gone, the sullen girl, who once asked me when my shift was up, to which I replied 6, to which she answered, I love you more than all the seconds between now and then. Who stepped over the drunk's mattress and tossed in a coin, which was stolen before he finished fucking and before the fat man was finished being fucked, who entered the bodega and gave $1.30 to Al-Qaeda. You are exquisite and fairer than fear, girl. If it is my bell you hear, then you know that there are no spoons to be had here at the moment, but corral the ponies to one side of the block, pause your party for a time, hang the hydrant water mid-air like a coat on a hook, and sharpen your knives with my hands. Then I'm going to read from a story called Skip. So this is the beginning, so you're not missing anything, but basically it's about a man whose father has suffered a stroke and sort of the dynamics in the family. And I'm only going to read part of it. Okay. No one takes photographs at funerals. This is the first thing Peter Tucker thought when he received the news that his father had suffered a stroke. People photograph other sad things, starving children, atomic bomb, Nagasaki. But unless one was a Kennedy, which Grandpa Tucker was not, one's memorial service goes largely undocumented, and life slips out of sight even earlier, though with just as many flowers than expected. Peter had to buy new clothing because of his father's weight loss. This perturbed him. He frequented outlet malls and spent hours at the racks, holding 3 or 4 sizes of each trouser on his arm, searching for dignity. He wished only for his father to be fat again. If it was possible, Grandpa Tucker was uglier now than he had been in obesity. Swimming around in his own skin, Peter began referring to his father as the camel with the wrinkly knees. Peter, on the other hand, had found weight. He found it on his stomach and in the spaces between the knuckles and his fingers. His father's illness had caused him to make certain sacrifices, which he allowed to replace the sacrifice of dieting. Every day after work, Peter stopped by his father's house. He parked in the driveway, entered the code for the garage, and unlocked the basement door with a key he kept in a jar. He could never decide whether security was necessary in a house of the demented elderly. On the one hand, people may take advantage. They may steal. On the other hand, he had already lost his father, and in that sense, there was nothing more to take. The caregiver, Fatima, was always beside Grandpa Tucker's bed. Sometimes she slept or watched television with him, staring at the screen with the same vacancy as her decaying employer. Grandpa Tucker loved having the television on so that he could repeat the words on the screen, stringing them together in odd ways. He had a sophisticated vocabulary, having been a prominent member of the Atomic Energy Commission in his working days, and if one tuned out just enough, it sounded like he was saying something intelligent, even profound. Fatima did not speak very much English, and it was unclear how much she understood. She was loyal and good to Grandpa Tucker and had extensive training through the agency. Fatima practiced a religion unfamiliar to the Tuckers, but offense was never taken, as it often is, on either side. For Christmas, Grandpa sat at the table with the rest of the family, with Fatima, feeding Grandpa Tucker and keeping him from becoming agitated while his children and grandchildren whispered things like, "Grandpa, you are a sweet, kind man," and "Grandpa, you love to play golf," in his ear. There were only two Tucker children, and between them and their dead mother, they hoped that Grandpa Tucker knew he was loved. One year, several ages into the stroke, Peter's sister Drew asked if he planned on giving Fatima a Christmas gift, as he usually did. Of course, he replied, though he had not yet thought about Christmas, and certainly not about Christmas gifts. If it was all right, Drew asked, would he mind contributing instead to a gift that she herself had picked out? She had found a designer purse bought in a designer shop in New York, just like the kind Fatima had purchased from a street vendor who sold knockoffs. Fatima had always wanted one, it seemed, but had not considered the prospect of ever owning one. Peter agreed that this would be nice. Christmas dinner this year was purchased at Au Manger. The sign on the door to the gourmet market said, "Au Manger welcomes you to the tastes of tomorrow." And because Peter wished it were already tomorrow, he appreciated this. It was freezing inside. The cooks stood behind their stations with white chef's hat and their names embroidered in italics on their coats. Chef Larry experienced the desserts of tomorrow. Peter strolled purposely up to Chef Karen, experienced the soups of tomorrow, and bought a large tub of the soup du jour. Opera played over the speakers. Back in the antique dining room, the Tucker family and Fatima chewed distractedly. "Turn it over again, mister. The subliminal aftermath takes persistence." "What was that, Dad?" "Skip Tucker, the spark plug of the team." "That was your basketball name, Dad." "That was his basketball you name." "At Amherst," Drew said through mashed potatoes. "Skip Ramey, the spark plug of the team," Grandpa Tucker screamed, knocking over his water. Fatima rushed out of the room for a towel. "What did they call Grandma?" Peter's son asked. His name was Henry, and Peter had custody for the evening. "La Belle Estelle," Drew said quietly. She tucked a strand of hair behind her ear and pursed her lips. She managed a tight smile in Fatima's direction, who was mopping up the last of Grandpa Tucker's mess. "Fuck Henry Kissinger," Grandpa Tucker spat. "Excuse me," Drew left the room. Drew returned with the gifts and dessert. The caregiver's reception of the purse was decidedly understated. She sat awkwardly at the table, feeling left out, as usual, from the Tucker family's dinner, though Grandpa Tucker was arguably far more left out than she. She turned the purse round and round, making a facial expression that Drew took as a smile, and saying thank you repeatedly in a quiet, accented voice. Placing the bag carefully back in the box and replacing the lid, Fatima turned back to Grandpa Tucker and moved the food around on his plate. Drew felt anxious and pleased, thinking to herself that it really was a fabulous bag. "The nature of a systematic polarization is inevitable, Stell. One must be diplomatic. Whiskey, whiskey." That was the year Fatima began turning the paintings around. Peter's new apartment was located at 30th and Q in Georgetown, only a few blocks from the Potomac. The apartment was small and with little light, but it had high ceilings and was situated on the second floor of a 19th century brick row house. It was a short walk to the university where he taught classes and puttered about, lackadaisically awaiting tenure. Peter liked his apartment well enough. The stair railing alone provided more elegance than he had ever lived with. But in the night, when sleep confused him, Peter would trip and fall on his way to the bathroom, bumping into walls that seemed to be where they shouldn't. After having pissed in an altogether unfamiliar toilet, he would find himself startled to return to an empty bed, the silence of no breathing resonating in his abdomen. When Henry stayed over, Peter often had the overwhelming impulse to ask his son to share his bed. His wife had handled the Christmas presents for Fatima, the balancing of the checkbooks, and other things. She had handled Henry. Since the divorce, Peter often had the sensation that one of his legs was shorter than the other, as if, in addition to balancing his income, his wife had also balanced his inner ear. He understood better now Grandpa Tucker's intensified disorientation after Grandma Tucker passed away. After dinner in the evenings, Peter liked to walk down to the water. He strolled under the streetlights with his hands in his pockets, the stop-and-go traffic of Wisconsin Avenue buzzing two streets over. He walked past locked bicycles and through the stench of hookah bars, down past the construction that had been going on since Henry was a kid. The boardwalks on the river were never empty at this time of night, and Peter would sit on a stone bench and eavesdrop on the passerby. Sometimes he smoked a cigarette just because his wife and mother had hated them. The Kennedy Center sat fixed across the water. Peter once saw two 13-year-old boys perform tap dancing there as a brief stop on their world tour.